Is that our host messing us around, ladies and gentlemen?
Here we are. You got my hand up. Hello. Welcome to We Got Paddy News to rather apt because I lost my voice earlier this week. So rather apt that I started this program muted. I start, as always, by reminding our viewers that in lieu of a registration fee, we encourage you to make a donation to charity. We have a growing list of charities we support. We've added Winston's Wits to our list over the last few days, a charity for bereaved children. So do have a look at our list on our website at wegotpaddynewsfeud.com or make a donation to a local charity of your choice. Now, we're delighted this evening to welcome the legendary Dr. Chris Leely, part of Montague Evans, renowned expert in all things landscape and heritage, vast intellect, Renaissance man, really, and somebody who I could spend probably about 3 days interviewing, but we're going to have to try and confine ourselves to half an hour. Chris, I'm going to have to ask you the usual questions. Where are you calling us from? What have you chosen as our theme? And what are you drinking this evening, if anything?
I'm in our offices in St. Mary-Axe in the City of London. Our theme tonight is London and New York. And I'm drinking some San Pellegrino Limonata.
Ah, very, very nice. Yes, well, you're the opposite of the Sting song, aren't you? You're a New Yorker in England. I assume you've been in New York. I'm on the stretch, so they seem to be worth holding out for now. We haven't got Paul because he is, in fact, in America. But I think he's actually in New York. Last I heard from him, he was within the Statue of Liberty. Very well timed. But Mary, you're in front of some rather funky looking art. Where are you this evening?
Good evening, everyone. Lovely to have you on the show, Chris. I am in the town legal offices in London, and there is my gesture, obviously, to London. And here is my gesture to New York, the Big Apple, one for real, a lovely apple done in wood. And I'm on London's finest tap water. Cheers.
Uh-huh. Cheers, Mary. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you, Charlie. Hello, Chris. And nice to see you. I've done a virtual inquiry from your offices in front of Paul Griffiths involving a tall building in London. We've done a few of those, haven't we? And what a fabulous building that is, actually. Just an extraordinary building. Yeah, I'm in our London offices. The Savoy Hotel is just down there. If you look at the picture just there, there's a slight angle shot of the Gherkin, where Sasha and I like to have regular parties. And Sasha and I have been at the LPDF annual dinner, sat just a table away. And we've just shared a cab back to our chambers. And I have to say, Zach Simons was very funny when he gave his speech. That's a huge event. I mean, Sasha will attest to this, just an enormous number of people at that event. I haven't got a drink, which is bad news because somebody's left the air conditioning on at 26 degrees. I can't turn it off. I'm boiling.
And Sasha.
Thank you, Charlie. Yes, I wish I could turn it to 32 degrees.
You used to do that when I shared a corridor with you, if you remember, Sasha.
I do.
I'd come in and I'd find my temp. My aircon was either turned right up to maximum in the summer or right down to minimum in winter. Then you and Sasha had been in.
I know. I miss being able to do that, darling. The volume cooking.
That's why I left.
Yes, Chris and I have had a very nice afternoon at the Land Promoters and Developers Forum. 600 odd people there, which is quite remarkable. An organisation started 6 years ago, but I think it's testament to the strength of feeling about those involved in one side of the profession. And I, like Chris, am in London, like Mary. We seem to have a London-centric show tonight, and it's delightful to have Chris M on, who we've all called, cross-examined, and enjoyed his company and insight for many years.
Indeed so. I'm actually driving through London as we speak, so we get to see various landmarks along the way. So, without further ado, I think, Sasha, I'm going to start with you, aren't you? You're going to tell us the news.
I am going to tell you the news. And I think, frankly, this week, for those who have not followed the national press, it's been pretty seminal because on Tuesday, the shadow chancellor, Rachel Reeves, gave a pretty seminal speech in the City of London, which is called the Mays Lecture, which is a pretty important speech for setting out economic policy. Now, before all of you think I've had too much to drink at lunch, don't realise this is a planning show rather than an economic show. It's quite fundamental that the key theme that she evolved and discussed in her speech was about planning reform. And I think it's really important for all of our viewers to be aware that the Labour Party put reform of the planning system fully at the centre of their economic agenda. Indeed, it was one of the three elements that she talked about, and she asserts that planning reform, her exact words, is the very centre of its economic policy. So I think we should all prepare ourselves. If the polls are right, the Labour Party are likely to form some form of government, either a coalition or a majority, by the end of this year, according to the polls. And their clear platform, as it espoused on Tuesday, was that the planning reform is at the very centre of its economic policy. Indeed, the exact phrase she used is reform of planning would be at the heart of the strategy for growth. And more than that, I mean, this is quite a significant criticism of the current planning system. She described the planning system as the single greatest obstacle to our economic success. Well, just take a moment to think about that. If that is the perception of the Labour Party and the perception of the shadow chancellor, who everyone thinks might well be the real Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I did see the real Chancellor of the Exchequer today in Green Park at 8:15 running around, doing a crisp, preparing no doubt for some run. But no, in all seriousness, it's pretty important if planning reforms at the very centre of the economic and political argument that the Labour Party perceive. And what is said is effectively that they have three elements. And I think it's very important in the light of the December changes to the NPPF. Labour strategy is, and proposal is, to have mandatory local housing targets. Secondly, to recruit more planners. And thirdly, to bring forward a generation of new towns. So those two are the three fundamental elements of Labour's proposal. Also, it is important to note that they are proposing a fundamental change to the national infrastructure scheme, and they intend to bring forward some quite significant changes to that. So I think there are four fundamental takeaways for everyone to think about: mandatory local housing, recruitment of new planners, and a whole tranche of new towns, and a reform to the national infrastructure regime is potentially in 2025 if Labour win as proposed, was predicted. We'll see some very significant changes to the system, and that I think deserves and is rightly the fundamental piece of news that I wish to bring to our viewers' attention this week, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Sasha. Watch this space as those policies are doubtless fleshed out. Nick, first case is Woking, where, aptly enough, given we have Chris on the show, some tall buildings have been allowed. And Chris, you're going to tell us about them.
No, I'm going to tell you about a solar farm.
Oh. I thought you were telling about Woking tall buildings. Someone's saying they're on script.
Shall I tell you about the solar farm?
Oh.
Shall I do
so? Tell us about the solar farm.
Okay, all right. The appeal that I'm dealing with is Milton Road, Gayton in Northampton. If we just bring up the decision, hopefully Rob has got the order right. Yep, and we can see it's a Secretary of State decision. It involves a just short of, as they often are, 50 megawatt solar farm. It was a inquiry held by Mike Robbins, as we can see, it was determined by the Secretary of State. Only the Secretary of State doesn't determine appeals anymore, apparently. It was given to a junior minister, so it was given to a Minister of State for Local Government, Simon Hall. And we can see it was recovered by the Secretary of State. Now, the Secretary of State has refused this decision. And what is interesting, the inspector recommended approval, Secretary of State refuses the decision. is the approach that the inspector takes. And then I'm just going to contrast that with two other decisions that have been made in the last couple of weeks. So first of all, if we go forward and have a look at paragraph 13, the main issue was landscape, character and appearance. Secretary of State took the view that the introduction of the panels and the other infrastructure, and there's quite a bit that goes with it, would introduce a fundamental change to agricultural land, and considering the scale of the proposal, there'd inevitably be a degree of change. But interestingly, he agrees with the inspector, the issue is not, therefore, whether there would be a material change, because of course there would, but the resultant adverse impacts and, not the material change and the adverse impacts, but the extent to which the approach taken to minimise any effects and then the balance to be taken against the benefits would arise. So this is quite a sophisticated approach to landscape issues and actually deciding a bit like a heritage case about the effects and then balancing those against the benefits. And as we see, what happened was the Secretary of State adopts some of the reasoning of the inspector, but then rejects some other parts of it. So if we go to paragraph 16, Secretary of State has carefully considered the evidence of both the appellant and the LPA and comes down in favour of the LPA's evidence as set out in the inspector's report. Talks in particular about public rights of way running through the northern parcel. There were two parcels to this scheme, in addition to a towpath along the Grand Union Canal, and the northern parcel adjoined the canal, and both landscape architects agreed, as you'd expect in year one, there'd be a significant effect, but the appellant contended that as a result of the mitigation, there would be much less effect at year 15, but the Secretary of State rejected that, considered there'd be a significant impact for a number of years, and relying on landscape mitigation, there'd be less effect at certain times of the year. So obviously in the winter, and is a major consideration. So he concluded that the northern parcel would be is of higher susceptibility to change from a solar proposal, and considers medium high susceptibility would be afforded. So this is the language that we're all used to in terms of landscape impact, but being used really directly by the Secretary of State to reach conclusions, not to just say there's an adverse impact, but to look at susceptibility and then balance the impact against the benefits. If we go forward again, we've got paragraph 29, and this is to do with heritage assets. And in particular, the Grand Union Canal. The Secretary of State notes there's a management plan for the conservation area of the Grand Union Canal, describes the overall character as being defined by the gently curving canal, the modest grassy towpath, and the surviving bridges, with its setting being a particular note as it passes through the river valleys. And he agrees with the inspector the significance of the Grand Union Canal lies in its history and architectural value, which includes the engineering of the contoured route of the canal. And for that reason, he agrees that the northern parcel of the appeal site is an element of the setting of the Grand Union Canal. And if we go forward, the introduction of solar panels would alter that relationship to the canal, an appreciation of its embankment form with a rural landscape, and that there would be harm to the setting of the Grand Union Canal, probably the conservation area. The Secretary of State agrees the harm is limited to a short stretch of what is a very, obviously, very long linear conservation area, but he finds the harm to the setting to the Grand Union Canal, even in that short stretch, is moderate in the lower to middle end of less than substantial harm. That's language Chris obviously spends his entire professional life wrestling with. And there we see the Secretary of State dealing with it. If we just go forward, I'm going to speed up a little bit. There was reference to a turnover bridge and the impact of the solar farm on the context of that bridge. And again, the setting of the bridge, even with the planting, would be affected. If we go forward again, Secretary of State emphasising a particular issue that Rishi Sunak was talking about in the House of Commons yesterday, which is this focus on food production. So we're all used to whether land is in best and most versatile agricultural land, and we have to look for 3A, 2 and 1, for example. But actually, what the Secretary of State was interested in when asking for further representations was whether the land was being farmed. And you can see that the planning consultant, Nick Pleasant, wrote back and said, well, the land is not in food production, actually. It's being used for animal feeds and crops. That's a theme that the government keeps emphasising. Finally, then, we come to the last few paragraphs. I just emphasise this. A lot of weight's given to, obviously, renewable energy, enhanced biodiversity, creation of employment opportunities, and the fact the site, as a temporary permission, as solar farms usually are, would be returned to agriculture at some stage, but he gave that negligible weight. And if we just go forward again to 47, in line with the heritage balance set out in paragraph 208 of the MPPF, the Secretary of State has considered whether the identified less than substantial harm to the significance of the designated heritage asset is outweighed by the public benefits of the proposal, taking into account the public benefits, so all that benefit of renewable energy, biodiversity advancement, the Secretary of State considers the benefits of the appeal scheme are not collectively sufficient to outbalance the identified less than substantial harm to the significance of, obviously, the Grand Union Canal Conservation Area. And so he didn't apply the tilted balance in this case as a result of not finding the public benefits test passed. And we often find the public benefits test is passed in respect of housing and all the affordable housing it delivers. But here the Secretary of State is saying no. So those are the paragraphs that I wanted to highlight. But the other thing I just wanted to mention ever so briefly is that that decision was a refusal by the Secretary of State, but he also granted, not far away in Northamptonshire, the Great Wymondley solar farm in the Greenbelt with apparently more heritage harm. So there's a real consistency issue between this decision and what happened in the other Secretary of State decision for apparently greater harm, but allowed that one. You can find details of that. Theo Osmond-Smith has done a little LinkedIn post called Solar Watch, and it covers and summarises the apparent conflict between those decisions. There might be a legal challenge to the decision I've just been talking about.
Let's move on. Now we've got the lovely Mr. Tucker coming in from New York to tell us about the Woking case.
Thank you, Charlie. Well, as you can see, I am not in the northeast of England at the moment. That's the Rockefeller Centre, that's St. Patrick's Cathedral, that's Madison Avenue, and Fifth Avenue is just behind there somewhere. So I have taken our guest's attendance literally, and I've decided to go to his alma mater. And I'm not a million miles away from Columbia University, which is that away. But I'm going to tell you about an appeal decided on the 13th of March by Mr. Inspector Shrigley to allow an appeal and grant planning permission for 25 stories in one building involving 224 residential units and some commercial work on the ground floor. I think three units. This is located within the town centre of Woking followed a six-day inquiry which took place in January. The scheme was submitted in July of 2022, refused in March of 2023, and ultimately granted in March of 2024. 2 years to get a 25-storey scheme together. To be honest, looking out the window, 25 stories looks extraordinarily small in this context. There were issues of affordable housing. This provided actually the 40% affordable housing. So the issues were actually positive issues, but they were secured by 106 and also affects an SBA, also solved by a 106. But there were three remaining issues, one of which was the inadequacy of car parking. This was essentially a car-free scheme. The minimum requirements for their parking standards within Woking Borough would have given rise to 179 spaces. This scheme provided six disabled and one car club space. I confess, I always find this sort of reason for refusal completely baffling on the large schemes that I deal with, on the basis that if you're promoting schemes in the middle of an accessible town centre where your facilities are within walking distance and you have obviously excellent availability of public transport, why on earth would you want to provide more car parking and encourage people to have cars? The other issue, which is slightly odd, is the issue of amenity spaces for residents. So the amenity space was said to be below standard on the scheme itself. However, it's located within a town centre, with lots and lots of opportunities for recreational, formal and informal recreation. And there must be an expectation that those who choose to live in a town centre flatted scheme will want to give rise to recreating within town centre locations. It just makes sense. So to require maximum standards seems a bit odd. The central issue seemed to be the issue of character and appearance. And there was a statement of common ground which narrowed this down to height, bulk and massing. It's a town centre location. It's the location where the core strategy sought to direct large and tall buildings. And as you'll see from the graphic that Rob's put up, there was already consent for a number of tall buildings, and it was in a location where it will be read together with tall buildings. So it's in the right location, and it will be read together with those tall buildings. However, the council's case was that it was detached from the core of the town centre, and there was a conflict with a draft town centre master plan that the inspector gave very limited weight to. That master plan suggested that in this location one should have 4 to 6 stories. Well, that was roundly rejected by the inspector, and although he concluded that the scheme will be highly visible from a wide area, giving rise to major degrees of change, he concluded it would act as a landmark. It was well designed. It would deliver housing in a location where the core strategy required 2,000 odd units. It would deliver 40% affordable housing, and would be a good scheme. We can see the commercial units there on the ground floor. That also being a benefit, bringing vibrancy to this particular part of the town centre. So relatively straightforward. Couple of unusual points in relation to the scheme. As I said, the car parking is pretty robust. So if you're promoting a car-free scheme, this is one to look at if you're going for a large development within a town centre. And there's no reference in this scheme to the word beauty, beautiful, or high quality. It was taken as a given, and the inspector concluded that change would be a benefit to the town centre. So, good scheme. Well done to all those involved. And back to you, Charlie, for our New York correspondence. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Paul.
I am going to start. I'm going to take you to a Redrow appeal on largely open land in the Greenbelt on the eastern edge of Tring. And on a site which the inspector said was visible from some public rights of way and in views from an adjoining area of outstanding national beauty. And actually reading this decision reminded me, and I confess I'd forgotten, that areas of outstanding natural beauty were rebranded, and we must now remember to call them national landscapes. And you will see here that this is another decision on behalf of the Secretary of State, made not by the Secretary of State, but this time by the Minister for Housing and Homelessness. And when you realise that this was a scheme for 1,400 homes and a local centre, primary and secondary schools, sports and recreation hubs, public open space and SANG, perhaps you'll understand why that MP made the decision. So this was an inquiry that was held in between March and May 2023, and the inspector's report was received in August of last year, and there was an addendum report which he submitted in November, which covered off the HAP regs issue. Effectively, the inspector provided the Secretary of State with a shadow appropriate assessment. Now, we're in decorum, and decorum had a core strategy dating back to 2013. They had a site allocations DPD born out of that core strategy, and they had ancient saved policies from a 2004 plan. Housing land supply was said to be between 1.77 or 2.19 years, according to the inspector's report, depending on whether you took the appellant's figure or the council's figures, respectively. But of course, by the time the Secretary of State made his decision, MPPF 2023 was out. Perhaps because those figures were so low, there was no discussion about 5 years or 4 years or the transitional provisions. But it did mean that the Secretary of State introduced the 20% buffer onto the requirement figure in accordance with paragraph 67 of the new MPPF. And interestingly, the Secretary of State also rejected the position agreed by the parties and the inspector, which was that a historic shortfall should be added to the standard method requirement figure. The Secretary of State disagreed with that, but in the end, it didn't really make any difference. There was still a very significant shortfall. Now, at the end of a very long and detailed and careful report, the inspector found that very special circumstances existed. So I say now publicly congratulations to Chris Young and his team of 15 witnesses. The inspector found that the appellant's evidence had shown that the council had a history of failing to meet its commitments to deliver a local plan. The site had been included for release from the Greenbelt in a Regulation 18 document, but that document had been withdrawn. The inspector said that the development plan history and the failing development plan was an important factor in his determination of the appeal, which carried significant weight with regard to his findings about very special circumstances. And I'll come back to that in a little while. He attached substantial weight. That was the highest measure that the inspector adopted. He attached substantial weight to open market, affordable homes, first homes, and also the social economic benefits. Some factors relating to sport, recreation, education, and community benefits would serve more than the development required, and so that those additional benefits were given low, moderate weight by the inspector. But interestingly enough, the Secretary of State preferred the word limited weight. So the inspector found significant harm to openness and to two purposes of the Greenbelt. He found that there would be an adverse impact on the character and appearance of the surrounding area and the setting of the nearby AOMB. And 49% of this scheme was on BMV, best and most versatile agricultural land. And he gave significant weight against the scheme as a result of that. There was also some issues around designated heritage assets. He found less than substantial harm, but applying the balance 202 then, now paragraph 208.9.8 now, he found that the planning balance was in favour of the appellant. Now, all of that, all of those weighting exercises were accepted by the Secretary of State, except for one. And the other point to note is that the Secretary of State was clear in his decision letter that the proposal overall was contrary to the development plan. Whereas actually, when I looked at the inspector's conclusions, I couldn't find that there was a clear conclusion one way or another on that important topic. But the Secretary of State did not accept that the related failure to deliver a local plan was a matter that carried separate weight in the overall planning balance. And that is why, it seemed to me, he omitted that from his consideration, and overall he found that very special circumstances did not exist. Thus, there was a protective policy, i.e. the Greenbelt policy, that provided, he said, a clear reason for refusal. He considered that the adverse impacts would significantly and demonstrably outweigh the benefits, and so the presumption in favour of sustainable development did not apply. And so applying Section 38.6, he found that the proposal should be refused and that material considerations indicated that planning permission should be refused. And so it was. Thank you very much.
So, Chris, welcome again to the show. Your partner, Montague Evans, a large specialist team, works alongside you. You're not only a heritage expert, but you're also a member of the RTPI. Member of the Institute of Society Building Conservation, PhD in the History of Architecture and Urban Planning, dozens of publications, including, I think, a book on the Supreme Court, no less, where he edited Lady Hale and Tom Bingham, two legal legends, fellow of the Royal Historical Society, a whole host of high-profile cases, such as the Holocaust Learning Centre, British Museum, M&S, which is hence why you're on today, given the topicality of that issue. And as I said, you're someone from Greater New York, who's Italian-American, who's made the journey over here, and we're interested to hear about that journey and the lessons, the comparative lessons that you can share with us. And unconventionally, we're going to start with a question from Paul, actually, because that's really going to sort of lead us into that issue, and then I'll ask my question. So, Rob, if you can fire up Paul once again from America.
Thanks, guys. So my question is to Chris, as I sit here with these relatively modest developments as the backdrop, what lessons do you think the United Kingdom can learn from creating cities in North America based upon your experience on both sides of the Atlantic?
Well, I mean, I have to stray outside of my the heritage topic. I mean, I'll start with that in a way, because the heritage topic sort of informs the rest of the answer to the question. I mean, from the beginning, American preservation's always been about trying to find a viable use for historic building. And in that sense, I think it's really different to the way the heritage and conservation is evolved in this country. But I think second main difference is that Americans have always been, I think, more comfortable with living in dense and high-rise developments. I mean, it may come down to a really simple-minded delight in modernity. And I don't just mean modern style. I mean, you know, all mod cons and the efficiencies you have from it. And, you know, probably almost uniquely amongst people I work with and discuss tall buildings with, I've actually lived in tall buildings. And, you know, people live happy, full lives in them. You know, they get married, they have children, they enjoy themselves, they have wonderful outlook. They have the benefits in New York, for example. Within any one city block, you have a whole range of services because there's so many people that can support them. And if you get the amount of public open space like in Manhattan, you've got a fantastic park. Then, you know, it's a very comfortable way to live and a very successful way to live. And I think actually in this country, a younger generation is increasingly appreciating that way of living. And they've got to, really, because of the density requirements we all have to meet. And the only way to make best use of the land, really, bigger buildings. I guess the other point to make is that, you know, whilst I think this country can learn some things from the U.S., I think the U.S. could learn some things from this country. I mean, the standard of design in, I think, in American cities has steadily gone down, whereas the standard of design in British cities has gone up, whether it's in heritage contexts or, you know, entirely modern developments. I mean, there's a generality, of course, but I think we should actually be really proud of what we've achieved architecturally and in landscape terms in this country over the last 20 years. Well, Paul can't tell me if he's got any follow-on
questions. Thank you. No, he hasn't, but I don't know how he left up. You know, I was getting some wide narratives that, you know, the main differences between how planning is done in the US and UK, you sort of touched on that perhaps already. But if you had to pick one feature of the American way of doing things in our region and exported here, what would that be?
Well, I'm not sure I really would, because it's a highly legalized environment. Well, actually, here's one thing. There are certain environments where planning is just treated as a set of rules. You know, for example, in relation to householder developments, it's a really straightforward series of rules if you follow on setback, light, and so forth, where consent should be forthcoming, where an area is zoned for a certain kind of development. So that, I think, is an aspect of the American system which is really efficient, really, really efficient. But when it comes to the bigger forms of development, there's the same complexities, actually. And in some ways, a bit more horse trading and things taking, I don't want to be specific, but, you know, we have such greater clarity in this country, for example, around things like the tariffs you pay in connection with affordable housing or SIL contribution. And a lot of major developments in the United States, friends I have who work in this sector tell me it's more just like a negotiation with not too many tariffs, but it will vary so much from place to place because the American system is highly decentralized as well, which is, I think, one of the strong parts of this country. Planning system is its centrality and consistency.
Just like moving to the UK and how we do things. I mean, I've heard we you and I have had many a discussion about the difference between preservation and conservation of townscape and heritage. Any observations you'd like to make on that subject? Are we too obsessed or focused on preservation in this country?
I mean, by preservation, you mean the retention of absolutely as much of it
as
possible.
Yeah.
Well, I think we are, because there's conserving the built environment, you really have to make very careful decisions that are based on qualitative analysis. I mean, for example, and it's an obvious point, you know, the timber framing and internal features of an early 18th century house, you know, you work hard to try to keep that stuff because it's pretty rare, isn't it? And it's rare that it's evolved. But, you know, a Victorian house that's listed because of its facade from the 1890s, I mean, it's the stuff it's made from is the commonest stuff possible. Is that really part of the special interest listed building? It isn't really, actually. And yet too often, even with the benefit of the framework and the sort of nuanced way we have understanding heritage, you know, people treat those more recent buildings as if they're quite old. And I just think that a different approach should be adopted. And that's what conservation should be, which is about a sort of, you know, positive interaction with the building to give it longevity and durability.
As opposed to zero change, which is conservation seems to be interpreted. And then Building Beautiful. I can't not ask you a question about Building Beautiful. How has what I call the Building Beautiful agenda, that sort of sounds a little bit like a loaded term, but I don't mean it like that. But how has that and the associated changes to the MPPF that we've seen recently affected the way townscape and placemaking matters are considered in decision-making? Has it affected your job? And has it been for the better, the worse, or has it not really made very much difference in practice?
No, it's made a lot of difference. So, I mean, first of all, you have to remember that, you know, as you say, the design agenda's got some history now to it. It goes right the way back to, you know, the major government, doesn't it? And it's invigorated by the Labour Party with Kate and so forth. But in the late 90s and 2000s, there was a real emphasis on architectural novelty, to use architecture as a way to stimulate interest and investment in places. But, you know, there's been a reaction against that because it's led to a kind of exhibitionism and a sort of menagerie approach almost to collections of big buildings where everyone is different. It's a little discordant, some people might say. In the last 4 or 5 years, there's been much greater emphasis on a contextual response so that even, you know, really substantial buildings, like, for example, the one I did with Chris Young that he referred to earlier with Mr. Griffiths, you know, are having to demonstrate that, you know, they need to have regard to, you know, local characteristics, material proportions, and so forth. And that has changed the way we advise clients and the way architecture is done. And it's made a notable change. You can see it already taking effect. Is it a good thing? Yeah, it probably is a good thing. But, you know, history will come around and things will be different in another 10 years' time, you can be sure, you know, because it never... the history of taste is a history of change, right? There's no linear right answer. Yeah.
What about tall buildings? We heard the Paul give the discussion of the Woking case earlier on. Been a lot of tall buildings cases. Not necessarily easy to draw a golden thread through them all in terms of consistency or principled approach. So, really, my question for you is, Chris, is current policy and decision making relating to tall buildings working? And if not, what would you change?
Yeah. Well, by the way, I've done a few things in Woking Town Centre. They were on that model that Paul flashed. I've been coming with Mr. Braithwaite about too, so, which was a crack, I have to say. But I mean, so I guess London is the testbed for all this. And, you know, I was one of the people who worked on the London View Management Framework back in 2004-05, which is the document we use, you know, to manage buildings and the strategic views. And at that point, the London Plan had what I would call a promotional approach, which is very loose locational. And that's led to a lot of disquiet, who knows the population at large, but in certain parts of the population, I guess, that matter to politicians. And what's happened gradually in London is that the policy has become more locationally tight and quite specific about amount and size. And London plans now are required, London local plans required by the London plan to identify areas and indicative heights. So the trouble with that is those heights are being established without reference to really, you know, the things you need to know when you design a tall building: sunlight, daylight, rights of light, infrastructure, building orientation, plot size. And as a consequence, lots of tall building allocations are getting adopted in local plans, which are undeliverable. And it's leading to just incredible tension in the system in a way that there wasn't before. Some local authorities are being quite loose in the wording that they're using, like Lambeth, but others are taking a strict approach, and it's actually going to prevent sites from coming forward.
Do you think the Shard have got permission in today's climate?
it's hard to imagine. I don't think it was positively allocated for a tall building.
Yeah.
It's quite early.
No, quite. Yeah. No, you do think some of those landmarks that came, London landmarks that came in that sort of era, the Gherkin was a little earlier, backfires, etc. It's quite hard to see how they necessarily would have got approval in the current.
Well, it's sort of no small irony, is it, that they'll list the buildings of the future, these buildings. Mm.
Well, quite. Absolutely. I wanted to move into the future and talk about tech and how that might assist consideration of the kinds of issues that you give evidence on regularly as inquiries. We often have photo montages of different degrees of granularity, but what about virtual reality? If we go to an inquiry in, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years' time, will we just ask the inspector to don a visor and do a virtual walk around the development?
No, I've done that already, actually. I did the first one of those about four years ago with Colin Ball. And this the costs are reducing greatly. But, you know, the other thing that, I'm working on in another venture is the use of technology to measure human response to change in the visual environment. I mean, at the moment, we base decisions, really important decisions, on static images, which bear no resemblance to the way we actually perceive the world and understand it through our eyes. There's allegations of visual harm based on, the worst kind of, not even surrogates for human vision, just, poor representations. And we make assessments almost on the basis that these views are like pictures or paintings, and it's not the way we see the world at all. So I'm hoping that the use of technology is going to make these decisions more democratic and more reliable, maybe, even.
Quite a good time scale are we looking at for these kinds of innovations to come forward?
Oh, well, the next year, and we're already beginning to use them, actually. But they will begin to feature in public inquiries in the next year to 18 months, absolutely.
Good. I'm going to ask my question, if I may, Chris, if that's okay. We've got a little connection problem there with Charlie. So my question is, when we look at the law and the policy surrounding heritage assets, have we just made it too complicated in terms of decision-making?
I think we have. I mean, when you think about all the cases that potentially bear on heritage matters, right? There are just so many. It comes up all the time. You think about all the guidance that exists, different stages of preparation. Much of it, if I'm really being straightforward, says the same thing, really. Doesn't add anything particularly. And then you have, the result, the courts, as it were, weighing in about the weight to be given to heritage impacts, which is misinterpreted all the time by local decision makers and in local planning contexts, really, rather unfortunately. When in fact, it's not so much about great weight. Yes, you have to give it great weight as a matter of law. It's really about the nature of the impact and whether or not it makes a difference to the way you understand something. I mean, the approach we should take is super simple, right? Why is it interesting? Now, that's an easy question, but that is an expert judgment, right? That's an expert, I can do that. I've been doing this for a long time. You need to study, you need to look, you need to understand things. And then do we affect what's interesting? That's it, really. It's no more nor less complicated than that. And, the whole consideration around setting has just made that really simple question very difficult. And you see in all the cases the way it's either a confounding or a complicating factor, given too much weight, maybe, I don't know, on the facts of any one case, maybe, maybe not.
That is a beautifully elegant answer to the question, and I think we're all just nodding.
Is the concept of less than substantial harm useful?
Yeah, I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I understand entirely why the framework introduced it in the context of introducing a balance, right, around harm, and the very sensible decision that, well, actually, if you're going to demolish a building, let's be honest, you need a really good reason, a listed building, obviously. But as soon as you introduce that distinction, you invite all kinds of complex arguments around it and the scaling of it and what the boundary is between substantial and less substantial.
Exactly.
The framework was published, it seemed to me pretty clear. Substantial harm is you're knocking something down, or pretty well knocking all of it down.
Yeah.
But it's become so teased into describing impacts that aren't remotely that severe.
I don't know how this new did like the one of the decisions that we heard about earlier, where
substantial harm,
upper end of best substantial harm, and it's a concept that's so broad that arguably it's sort of meaningless, really, or not very helpful, well, at least decision making.
But also remember, it's harm to the whole of the darn thing, right? That's the test. All the statutory provision is around impact on the asset as a whole. You know, and so a moderate level is quite a lot, actually, even of less than substantial harm. So,
yeah, agreed. Mary.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I want to take you, Chris, to the M&S decision and to ask you, what are your thoughts, please, on the whole carbon issue post the M&S challenge? And also, since the only ground of challenge that was lost in that decision related to the impact on heritage assets, I wondered, as an expert, what is key in your view to understanding the impact on any setting? So, sorry, that's two for the price of one. But at least it allows Charlie to be quiet for a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, I think for all, you know, you plannerx on the program, right? The main decision you need to know is the decision by Paul Griffiths in the Edith Summerskills House case, which is a Secretary of State decision from 2020. Mr. Griffiths, we know, very senior inspector, has had most of the big heritage setting cases pitched to them, right? And so he's heard it many times from your brethren, okay? And he's distilled it beautifully in this decision. And essentially, it goes like this. He says, look, in setting cases, it's only the significance that the asset derives from its setting that can be affected. And that it's obvious the intrinsic interest of the asset is retained. It's not affected. So, you know, I started out doing listing when I was at English Heritage, as we were. We didn't list things because of their setting. We listed them because how much there was of them and what they looked like and how old they were. And then Mr. Griffiths says that unless an asset derives, as he put it, a major proportion of significance from its setting, that it's unlikely that the harm can creep up very high in the less than substantial scale. Well, there it is. And, you know, I think the real problem is that people are using the same words and the same gradient for direct and indirect effects. They're wholly different, actually, in their nature, obviously, because a setting impact doesn't make a building any less worthy of protection, for example.
So maybe that's what policy should be directed at, rather than substantial, less substantial. So don't knock it down, and then direct effects versus indirect effects. That might be a better distinction in a policy.
I think so. And you
reformulated.
I think that's absolutely right. And it has caused a lot of mischief, this point. We all spent a lot of time, obviously, dealing with this point.
Yeah.
And then on carbon, Mary. M&S. Yes, yeah, so I'm working on it for 5 years. and people on the call know what happened. The only ground that did fail was on the challenge point. It's quite interesting what Natalie Leaven said. She said that on that point, you know, she dealt with it very shortly. She said, in my view, it's very important that the tests for impact on heritage assets do not become even more complicated and subject to an even more complex legal reasoning process than is presently the case. So step away, basically, is what Judge Leaven said. Don't need to go there, because, of course, we won on 5 or 6 grounds anyway. But on the carbon point, I mean, that really has changed things, because I think what M&S crystallized for me was the way in which, or put another way, there's a whole category of, let's use the word asset, you know, old thing out there, which is now called a non-designated heritage asset. Okay? And there are a lot of them, because guess what? We live in an old country. Okay? They're everywhere. You know, that's a wonderful thing. But they're not listed. They're not remotely of listable quality. And they don't deserve the special attention that a listed building or conservation area gets, or a scheduled monument, et cetera. And so what M&S did was it enabled the carbon argument to fold into the non-designated heritage argument. And for the two of them to reinforce the other. And in that way, to give more weight to the retention of old buildings which are not listed. Because let's remember, the principal protagonist in this case was Save Britain's Heritage. Okay? And the result has been, consequently, that, you know, any new site I look at now has an old building on it of any consequence you know, I don't mean listed. You look at it, oh, that's kind of interesting. I say in my expert way, it's kind of nice. You know, that if you instantly say to the client, do you know, there's a risk here that this is going to happen. Now, as to what the complexities of carbon and so forth, I mean, look, we're all professionals on the call. I've done a lot of big retention schemes. So we added, I'm looking at it now, actually, 14 floors to a Richard Seifert building from the 1960s in Islington. That was pretty good. That, you know, there's certain sites, they work fantastically for the client, actually, because you've got structure there already. You don't have to pay to demolish it. You just add to it and strengthen it. It's fantastic. There are some sites where it makes perfect planning and economic sense. But other sites, it just doesn't work. You know, we said that M&S was one of those sites. That was our case. And so, but undoubtedly what it does is it obviously, we're going to have to do more. We have to do whole life cycle carbon analyses now on buildings for major developments. And if there's a heritage dimension, there's going to be that added twist to it. And it makes it a little bit more difficult, I think, than it maybe needs to be.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for that very useful insight. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Mary. Sasha, what's your question for Chris?
Thank you, Charlie. Yes, because I just wonder, in many of the cases that we all do, heritage is utilized as a reason for refusal, either paragraph 208 or 209. And I just wonder if you've got any view on whether one could insert or impose some form of gateway test to ensure that what's truly valuable is kind of recognized as such and cry wolf doesn't occur as it often does in the heritage field, frankly, currently.
Well, it's funny, you know, in the PPG on the designation of conservation areas, there's an admonition. You don't often find this kind of thing. And what the Secretary of State has said is that when designated conservation areas, local authorities should ensure that they genuinely merit the designation. It's quite interesting that, isn't it? There might be a similar admonition in relation to local lists, okay? Because, I mean, why put something on? What is the gateway test for that? It's interesting in a local context. Well, it's not been defined anywhere. But I think that guidance could be crafted, possibly in the framework or the PPG, really to emphasize the point that when looking at a listed building, it's important to understand the relative significance of every bit of it as the basis for actually, you know, sustainable regulation of the built environment, instead of just every bit of it. And, you know, the framework tried to do that in its approach, but it has had the unintended consequence of turning every building into an archaeological site, virtually. You know, everything has significance because it's old or it's part of a historic structure in some way. But in fact, we all know, well, any expert will tell you, it ain't all equally good. You know, even within the category of grade two buildings, there's a huge variety of quality and interest, even within that massive category, and equally within higher grades too.
That's a really interesting question. There's a style of analysis for heritage matters I quite like, which is, you know, what are the principal contributors to the significance, and then what's the effect of the development on each of those contributors, which gives a sort of proportionate analysis of the overall effect. But decisions don't often seem that nuanced. The evidence may be that nuanced, but decisions seem to sort of generally tend to favour the you know, change is bad approach.
Well, I mean, Well, that's you saying that as the barrister in the room arguing the case. I'm the witness, and this is going to be played back, obviously. But no, I think it. Well, no, I think inspectors do pay attention carefully. Mm-hmm. When I hope they do, or they seem to anyway. When I'm giving expert evidence, and that's the way I give it. And also when I meet authorities, equally. I mean, if that nuance doesn't find its way into the decision, I don't think that means it hasn't been recognized necessarily. Mm. Decisions necessarily are compressed. Not every aspect of a case. But you do occasionally find decisions where there are these fine distinctions made, where it's absolutely central. I had one once which was about whether or not a piece of land was a medieval clearance or an 18th century field. And we relied on, you know, 16th century documents to prove it wasn't old, you know, so... And the inspector had to make a finding, and it was jolly important. It was in an AON. It was in a national landscape. Sorry, national landscape.
That's what we now have to call them. Yeah. Last question from me, Chris. Your favourite shotgun to the head. Your favourite heritage asset and your favourite building, if not a heritage asset, in the UK.
Well, the Albert Memorial by George Gilbert Scott from the late 1860s, which is the reason I decided to study Victorian architecture. So it fond feelings for it. And and actually the Lloyd's Building, which is just at the bottom of St. Mary Axe, which I'll tell you, when it was published in the Architectural Review, I picked up that magazine from Columbia Architectural Library, where I was reading for my PhD. I went to that library, and we could not believe it. I mean, it was jaw-dropping, actually. And, you know, I've had the amazing good fortune to work with Graham Sterk, the architect of that building on the British Museum extension, which is my third favorite, actually.
Well, once again, Chris, thank you very much indeed. Lots of hearty comments in the chat. We are back in a few weeks' time with the next series, and we will announce the 18th of April. We'll announce our guests. We're lining up some great guests for that series. So in the meantime, have a good break. Happy Easter if you celebrate it. Happy holidays if not. And thanks again, Chris. Good night.
Thank you, Chris.